I don't know whether you know, but this year is the 1,700th anniversary of one of the most defining events in church history, other than Jesus' death and resurrection. I don't know whether you know that. About 1,700 years ago, there was quite a lot of discussion, shall we say, about what it meant to be a Christian and who Jesus was. Because for 300 odd years, the gospel of Jesus had gone out all over the known world, and lots of people had picked it up and gone, yeah, this is amazing. And then they'd all added their own little bits to it here and there. And then some of those bits became more important, and some of those bits became more confusing. And because they hadn't at that point got a single written down Bible that was still in the process of being assembled, then it was a little bit complicated. So there's a guy called Constantine, who was the Roman emperor at the time, who had finally realized that whatever happened, unless he let the Christians have a significant role in the Roman Empire would collapse, because they'd gone from being 11 people to being something like 25% of the Roman population. And they were having this huge effect. They were changing the values of the community from slavery being absolutely fine to slavery being not so good. For women being treated as possessions and muck to women being allowed to lead churches. All sorts of things had been going on, and it had unsettled the Roman Empire so much that they said, what we need to do is get everyone together who is a leader in a different sort of church, and we're going to get them to sit down and work out, what is it that makes the Christian faith the Christian faith? What is it that makes this work? So they gathered them all in a place called Nicaea, which is in Turkey. And they got the great and the good and some of the not so good as well, all in one place, and had this conversation. Now, if you've been in the room, this is a question for all of you, children in particular, but adults as well, and said, well, who was Jesus, or what does it mean to be a Christian? What would you have said needed to be included? What bits might need to be in there? Just wondering if you've got any thoughts. Adults, children, hamsters. What are your thoughts? What do you think might be important? Kath, I'm going to pick on people. What might be important to say who Jesus was or what being a Christian is?
It's love for your fellow men.
So it's something about loving humanity and each other. Okay, that's a thing. What else have we got? Francis.
Well, I think you'll have to include the crucifixion and the resurrection from the dead.
Jesus' death and resurrection. I would suggest that's quite important, although some of the people there didn't think it was. What else? Any other thoughts? Peter.
His outstanding love for everyone.
Interesting. Any other thoughts? At the back. Pat Rowe.
Virgin birth, born of a virgin.
Virgin birth, the fact that Jesus wasn't just a normal person, there was something different about him. Any other thoughts? Middle section anywhere. Any thoughts? It's a really big question, isn't it? She's like, I've come to church and they're asking me for the things that he's meant to answer. Stephen, what are your thoughts? I'm going to pick on you because you're here.
Resurrection.
You think resurrection's big? Carol, any thoughts?
Yeah.
Sorry? No, I'm not. Oh, you're a wise woman. Well, what they did was they had these huge discussions, and they went on a while, and they came up with the first version of what they called the Creed, or the Nicene Creed. And then about four decades later, they had a rerun at it and fine-tuned it a bit more. But in amongst these things, one of the most famous people of the whole of Christmas was involved. So do you know that Santa Claus is an aberration or a made-up thing that came from St. Nicholas? Okay, St. Nicholas was a real person, and St. Nicholas was at one of these councils. Now, he's famous for giving presents, but actually what he did, the thing that really made him famous, was there was a family with three beautiful teenage daughters, and they were so poor they couldn't afford a dowry, which meant that basically the only way they could make a living was to be sold into human slavery, shall we say, with men, for want of a better way of describing it. And he went, that won't do. So he sneaked in and basically left a dowry for each of the three daughters so they could get married. So basically, he's famous not for riding around with flying reindeers, but for actually saving people from prostitution and for saving people from people trafficking. But he was there, and he got so cross with someone who was talking utter piffle, I think is the polite way to put it, he is reputed to have punched him and knocked him out. St. Nicholas punched out a bishop. It was that bigger thing at the time. They had to work out what is real and what isn't. What is Jesus and what isn't? What's our imaginings and what is God? It's a really hard thing to do. And they came up with this understanding, and rightly so, that whatever the apostles, the people that knew Jesus and lived with Jesus and then took the church out, whatever they were saying, you know, this is the things of God, well, that's the best evidence we've got, so that's what we should listen to. So when we say the creed, you'll notice at the end of it, it says something like, we believe in one Catholic and apostolic church. Catholic doesn't mean Roman Catholic, it means universal, as in all the churches that are seeking to follow Jesus, as the apostles told us about him, are one church, whether it's here or the United Reformed Church in Tintwistle or the, you know, the independent church in Manchester, wherever it is, it's one church with different flavours and different sub-communities, if you like. But what they gathered around was what they called apostolic faith. What was it that the apostles, the Peters, the Johns, even Paul, said, this is who he was, this is what he did, this is how we're to live. Rather than someone called Thomas who wrote an interesting book and thought, I'll make these bits up because they make it more interesting or more human. So the reason I'm mentioning this is it's 1,700 years since it happened. If you're interested, it was also on Songs of Praise last week, I've been told. But also, as we go through and look at the different things we do some of the time in our worship, it's really important that we remember where it's come from. That we don't get to choose to a degree what we believe as Christians. There is a faith of the church, and we might struggle with bits of it, but it is the faith of the church. It's been there for a really long time for a really good reason, because it's what God has shown us of himself. Not what we think he should be, or not what we want him to be, but who he truly is. So this is one of those Bible passages that makes you bite your lip and go, ooh. But before we come to it, I want you to have a little think with me about something really, really important. Have you ever thought about doing the Great Manchester Run? No. Some of you, it might not be on the agenda anymore, but once upon a time, I decided I was going to do the Great Manchester Run. I signed up 3 times for Great Manchester Run. And I discovered during those 3 seasons of enthusiasm for this that there are 2 different ways of preparing to do the Great Manchester Run or any other fun run or similar. The first one is you register. You have every intention of going running a couple of times a week, but then it rains and you don't feel like it. And then it's dark and you don't fancy it. And then it's been a tough day at work and you don't quite get out there. And then the children have got tonsillitis so you don't quite go. And before you know it, it's the day beforehand and you really don't quite feel that you can do this because actually you've only been running 3 times in 6 months. And 6 miles is suddenly a very long way. And you don't go. You stay at home and go to church instead. That was my first attempt. My second attempt, I took a different approach, which went something like this. I booked a place on the run, and then I put together a training plan. And in my diary, I had days when I'd do some running and days when I didn't. And then I negotiated with a few of the guys I worked with at the hospital at the time, and twice a week we would go running in our lunch hours together. So they were there to keep me going and keep me honest. And then another time during the week, a friend of mine from home, we would go running together and he would keep me honest and keep me going. So we had days of running and glorious days when we didn't have to run. And it was fab. And this went on and on. And you got the help, you got the support, you expected that it was going to be a bit like hard work, and you got your earbuds loaded with appropriate tunes, bought yourself a fancy water bottle and off you went. You put in the training. You accept that you can't enter pie-eating competitions and alike because you've got to be at the peak of physical perfection. You accept that it's going to spoil your social life and your TV watching. And you accept that at times it will make you tired and weary. But when the day comes, and you're ready, and you're there, and you're with 20,000 other people that are ready and are there, everyone around you cheering you on and encouraging you, what a day. I remember running towards the darkest place in Greater Manchester. Some people call it Old Trafford. I consider it a dark place. And suddenly, from nowhere, I heard these two voices bellowing, "Come on, Bruce, you can do it." And I looked over, and there were two slightly older ladies leaning over the railing who'd clearly read my name there, decided I needed a bit of encouragement, and boy, did I need some encouragement. And were bellowing out my name, "You can do it." I was like, "Yes, I can, I can. I can get turned around to the Old Trafford car park and head back the other way. I'm more than halfway now." And with other people's help, and my mate Steve, who was always two paces ahead of me, but with me in his rearview mirror, so to speak, I ran the Great Manchester Run. 2 years in a row. What a sense of achievement. What a sense of satisfaction. What actually, to be fair, a little bit of a sense of disappointment afterwards, because you're like, you've done it. You're like, oh, what do I do now? It's a year till the next one. But the two approaches reflect something really important in life. The first is basically, I like the idea of it, but I'm unwilling to do the work to make it happen. And the other says, I recognise the cost and I accept it. I want to do this and expect and accept the work, the tiredness, the limitation. I am willing to pay the cost. And this is exactly the point Jesus is getting at when he talks about, you know, the Bible reading we've just had. Before you start, look at what it's costing. And do the maths. Is it a price you are willing to pay? You see, in the previous chapters, it had all been glory and wonder. This crowd, now of possibly thousands of people, had seen Jesus heal the sick, raise the dead. He'd seen Jesus free people from possession of the evil spirits. They'd seen people, 5,000 people fed with a packed lunch. They'd heard stories about Jesus calming a storm in the middle of a sea. They'd heard stories from Jesus saying God invites you to the banquet to join in with him, to be a part of all that he is and all that he's doing. You could be welcomed and accepted. No matter who you are, you don't have to be the right stuff. You just have to accept the invitation. And it all sounds great, doesn't it? Power to restore, the power to change things. Some of our problems solved. Easy food, and if you're going to John, easy wine as well. To become a child of God. It sounds great. It sounds easy. It sounds amazing. And it is. But Jesus is now bringing a dose of reality into the flip side of it, if you like. He's saying this isn't fairy godmother wandland. We're not going to go dink and all becomes well. It's going to be costly, and you have to give up everything. And give it to Jesus. So last week, for Harvest, we were talking about how, you know, those wonderful lines in written by David and then sung again by Solomon, that when they say, God, all things come from you, and of your own do we give you. We talked about just this idea that everything we have and everything that we are and every opportunity we're given, all of this stuff is a gift from God. And we're saying, well, God sort of wants it back. Not in a you can't have it way, but in a entrust it to me and we'll make life flourish kind of way. And if you're not sure about that, if you look through our Bible passage, there's a fairly comprehensive list. We have to give everything to Jesus. He says, Jesus says he needs to be more important than our family relationships and priorities. Verse 26. Verse 27, he's got to be more important than a comfy life and good social standing. We'll come back to that. Verse 27 continues, your freedom to do what you want and how you live your life. You're giving that to Jesus too. Your very life itself by the end of verse 27. And then if that's not covered at all, you get to verse 33. Jesus says, everything that you own too, by the way. Your life, your relationships, your freedom, your choices, your possessions, everything. So it has to be given back to God. Everything that God has given us. And that's when you get to follow me. That's when life is worth it, because I promise to bring you life and life in all its fullness. Now and for eternity. But it is at the ultimate cost of handing over your choices and your freedom to Jesus. So if we go to verse 26, the first half of it, Jesus is saying, love me more than your family. Now, I have had conversations over the years with a number of people, and to be honest, they tend to be mums and grandmas. They go, how can God possibly say that? How can he ask me to love anything more than my precious children or my precious grandchildren? And it's a really big question. It does seem to sit contrary, doesn't it? Because God makes families, and God delights in families, and God says, you know, families are the fundamental unit of our society. I'm for it. Do you know what? I call myself Father, says God. So what's it all about? What's he getting to? Well, let's think of it this way. If there's a falling out in a family, as a follower of Jesus, our job is not to take sides, but to be like Jesus in that situation. To love and value both parties. To seek restoration and reconciliation in both parties, even if one wants you to side with the other and vice versa. And in families, that's really common. What else does it mean? It means that if a family member wants you to do something, whatever the something is, for the good of the family or a person in it, and it's something that is at odds with Jesus and his ways of doing things, then Jesus has to win. It says that, you know, if I formally want to play sport every Sunday, my children wanted to play football every Sunday. What do I do? Do I stop going to church? Do I let them go and play sport every Sunday morning? Do I let them not be part of a church's life? Or do I find a different way to square that circle? In our case, our kids played every other week. And then when they got old enough, they went to an evening service somewhere else and played every week. But they had to understand, from our perspective, what Jesus says, that football is great, rugby is great, but actually Jesus is greater. And we need a part of all of these things. How do we put Jesus more important than our family? By letting his priorities be our priorities. But that also makes us better people. It makes us better parents. It makes us better children. It makes us better husbands and wives. And actually, it's better for everyone, ultimately. So whilst Jesus is saying, yeah, I'm more important, but when you live that way, it makes everything else better anyway. We used to talk to people about how best to love your children. At one point, one of the conversations we had with one couple was the best way you can love your children is to love their mum. This is to the dad, and to the dad was to love their mum. Because actually what the children needed most was security, and their mum and dad were struggling. What your kids need most is for you to love each other, and the love of them comes for free. What we need is to love Jesus. The love of other comes for free. And we get to love like Jesus loves, which is a much better way. What else do we have in here? Verse 26, the second half. You need to love Jesus more than your own life. All things come from you, of your own do we give you. Includes our life. The most precious thing we've got is our lives. Jesus is saying, I gave it to you. Literally, I am the source of life. I gave it to you. I want you to give it back so we can use it wisely together. And for some people, that will mean being called to stand up for Jesus and die for him. 11 of the 12 disciples were martyred. There were numerous, there were literally thousands of Christians every day martyred in the world. Many of them in places like North Korea and Eritrea and Iraq. They're dying because they say, no, I won't denounce Jesus, even though you're going to kill me, because he's more important than you are. Thankfully, for most of us, that's not the case. But we might be called to live and work in places where people are broken and struggling, and it might not be glamorous, and it might not be satisfying, and it might be really costly, and we might have the abilities and skills to do all sorts of things, but God has called us there, and that's where we serve. It might be the reverse of that. He might give us amazing skills and gifts and say, I want you to be a person of significance and influence in our community or society so that you can influence it for the good. You can be a role model, an example of following Jesus. It might be that he says, I want you to be a person who creates wealth and employment, but to do it honourably and honestly. He might ask all sorts of things of us. And he says, yeah, this is what I want. I want us to live our lives the way that brings the most to the world, the most glory to God, and fulfills the most of our potential. It's a big thing. It's huge. And then, if that's not enough, Jesus then follows this off with this beautiful line, take up your cross and follow me. Jesus was killed as a common criminal because he lived and brought into the world something that people didn't want or like. Grace and truth is how John describes it. Jesus was a threat to the people in power. He was a threat to the religious leaders. He was going to destroy evil and darkness by overcoming them, not with violence or hate, but with light and love. Jesus was not wanted. That's the real reason he was crucified. People want the benefits of Jesus and the life that he brought, you know, the healing and the wholeness and all of those good things. But they weren't necessarily sure that they were going to let light and truth lead and guide their lives. People mocked him, they rejected him, and they vilified him. And that doesn't change today in places. I don't know whether you know, but crucifixion was only performed on the scum of the earth, as far as Romans were concerned. It was the scum of the earth, the slaves and below, they could be crucified to make a point. They'd be forced to drag the beam of their cross often through the town, people throwing things at them, hurling abuse, spitting on them and so on. They then nail them to it, tie them up, absolutely naked. There were no loincloths in Roman crucifixion. The ultimate humiliation, the ultimate shame. But he says, you've got to be ready for that too. That might be your lot. For most people, praise the Lord, it's not. But that idea that, you know, actually, whatever Jesus bore, we might have to bear a little bit of. Because we're called Christians. Christian means little Christ or little Jesus. And if Jesus did that, then sometimes his followers have to accept that that is a possibility too for them. This is not what you call good marketing, is it? And yet there is something so beautiful, so wondrous, so glorious and perfect in the other side of this that it's worth it if you can let go, if you will let go. Truth of the matter is our lives are not our own. We don't know how long we'll live. We don't know what it'll look like. I don't know what I'll be like in a year's time. I don't even know whether I'll be alive in a week's time. It's a foolish option to give everything that you are and everything that you have to another. It's a foolish option, it would seem, as far as our world is concerned, to hand over your understanding of life, the universe, and everything, for want of a better phrase, and give it to another and say, help me understand, show me what you know. On the other hand, it's not such a foolish thing if the person you're doing that to is the creator of the universe, who loves you so deeply that he came in person and died for you, that he cheers you on from the side, that he welcomes you even when you've messed it up and says, we'll try again, who wants to see the world that we live in made whole and beautiful and is working towards it and one day will achieve that. Maybe the benefits outweigh the cost. Running the Great Manchester Run, I got a medal on a ribbon. I've still got it in my drawer. And every so often I look at it and smile and go, I really should do something about this so that maybe there's a chance of getting another one. But what is on offer here is so much greater. It's not just good for our world. It's not just good for our families. It's not just good for our community and society. It is finding purpose and a reason to live and a thing to live for and an identity to live in with the one who loves us most perfectly and knows us the best, who knows the beginning and the end of all things. In 1956, to finish with, a missionary called Jim Elliot went with a group of others to share the gospel with the tribes in a particular area, the jungles of Ecuador. He left his wife and his children at home, and him and the others went. They also knew that anyone who tried to make contact with these tribes in the last however long had been killed. But they felt that they had to go. There was something in them that God was saying, do you know what? I'd love for you to go. I'd love for you to give these people a chance to meet me and to find me and to know me. When they were asked about the risk, Jim Elliot replied with a now really famous sentence. He said, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep, his life, to gain what he cannot lose, eternal life and hope in the love of God. Sadly, after 4 days, all five members of the team that he went with were killed by the people that they went to show love to. A while later, those very same people found Jesus when someone else went, and this time it kind of sank home or whatever. But I look at that and I think, could I? I'm so grateful I've not been asked. Could you? Could you do that? Could I do that? But when we get that perspective, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. When Jesus says, follow me, hand it all over to me and trust me with it, because where I'll take you, I wouldn't imagine, but it'll be glorious. I will be with you every step of the way, for now and eternity. So we're going to have a quiet minute in a moment, and I've got three questions that I'd like you to have a little think about. Have you counted the cost of what it means to follow Jesus? You might have done once upon a time, but have you thought about it recently? Have you gone, do you know what? I just need to remember this. That's one. Number two, are there things or areas in your life that you are holding on to that you just need to hand over to Jesus? Things that you might be ashamed of or you want control over? Have you given it all to Jesus? I know there are areas in my life that still need work in there. But finally, and equally important, do you need to experience some of God's strengthening and love in some of the situations you're in? Maybe there are places where you're trying to be Jesus, his hands and his feet. You're trying to love as he would. You're trying to just be an honest person in a place where that's not always the case. Do you need some extra strength and cheering on? Do you need to hear another person, or even better, God's voice say, come on, you can do it? It's a really heavy Sunday, I'm afraid, in terms of the content. But it's a really important thing. Are we there? And if we're not, do we want to get towards that place? So we're going to take a quiet minute before we sing our final song. Have you counted the cost? Is there anything you're still holding on to that you need to hand over? Or do you need some strength and support, some encouragement and some grace, some peace and some love from the Spirit of God to help you carry on where you are? To close your eyes and just let God speak. Holy Spirit, would you come? Would you speak to us? Would you open our hearts? Those things that seem hard, would you help us to hear? Those things that weigh heavy, by your Spirit, would you lift from us? While the circumstances might not always change, your grace will be enough. Those are things that maybe it's helpful to carry on thinking with and working with throughout the week. Have a think each day. How am I doing? Am I giving it all to Jesus today? What's he said in response? Where does he want me to be? Where does he want me to go?